Hello and welcome to What's So Funny, a podcast about the making of comedy. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen. You can find me on Twitter at ThatLevi. This episode features my guest, Bill Corbett, comedy writer and personality, I guess. He's most well known from Riff Tracks and Mystery Science Theater 3000, but he's done a lot of other things as well. And I think you guys will enjoy our conversation about writing jokes, writing for puppets, writing for Riff Tracks, and writing for the radio. So we won't waste more time, and we'll just get into my conversation with Bill. Bill Corbett, welcome.
Thank you, Levi. Nice to be here.
Thanks for talking to me. You have one of those gotta pick some credits kind of thing. Like, you have a lot of different things. I mean, I think you're probably still most well known for the Mystery Science Theater, mm-hmm. both writing and then the voice work.
Yeah.
But
I think that's fair.
Fair.
But not for that little obscure play that I wrote.
You remember the role you did in eighth grade? You do Riff Tracks now, which you both write jokes for and perform. Mm-hmm. The actual jokes, you say them. And then I know you write for the Riff Tracks site, too. There's some, like, comedy posts on there.
Here and there, although it's gotten a little overtaken, like a lot of things, by social media. We used to have a blog, and then it just, you know, little by little, the cobweb started accumulating.
Right, no one's here. Why don't we go where everyone is? And then you also, you write for other TV, you've done other miniseries TV stuff, I know. And movie stuff?
Well, I've done movie stuff. I was a screenwriter. I had one and only one screenplay actually made. And it was my idea. And I say this with some trepidation because it was not a good movie and not really a hit. But it got Eddie Murphy in it. It ultimately was called Meet Dave, although it started out as Starship Dave. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's not a proud moment artistically, but it did help my young family at the time.
So. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting, you know, I was lucky that I took a class from you many years ago, a screenwriting class, and you spent some time talking about the Meet Dave experience.
Right.
Which I know you.
Which
like,
is now going to be a ride, by the way, in Vegas. Meet the Dave. Meet Dave experience. No, I can't.
Amazing. Is it underwhelming? Like, people are in the line. People are like, "This sounds like a great idea."
Right.
They just sit there.
And then, as you come out, people frown at you, like you weren't very good on that ride.
No. But is it true for that? The making of that, you and your was it two, just you and one other person writing the screenplay?
Yeah.
You guys wrote a screenplay initially that you were proud of the story and the jokes, and there was stuff you were happy with, right? And then it changed?
Well, I'll say that with reservations. I don't know how much into the weeds you want to get here. I'll be, you know, smoking cigarettes down to the ashes, talking bitterly.
No,
it really is not a bitter story all in all. Like, I was disappointed with the outcome, but I saw it coming miles away. I had the idea, and I asked my partner Rob on board because he was a friend and I wanted to work with somebody. And frankly, he was a big Hollywood guy. He was working on Frasier at the time and worked on.
He's still working on Frasier.
Yeah, nobody told him it's over. It's like, Niles is dead. Move on.
And then there's a Jack Benny moment here.
Right. And then he worked on How I Met Your Mother. So he's really TV. We produced the first draft that I thought was pretty good. I tend towards the more absurd and eccentric than Rob, as we learned while writing it. And he is more about beat, beat, joke. So we had to negotiate a lot of that territory. But I thought the first draft was good. I think one of the main problems is they decided they wanted to make it into a kids movie where it didn't start out that way. And then it wound up as some unholy hybrid thereof.
Right. It's not for anyone.
Right. It is literally not for anyone. You know, along with the vagaries of going through directors and other sensibilities and all that. And the weird thing is I went out of it, as I've said before, kind of liking everybody I worked with. Like, the producers were nice guys, but ultimately it was all pretty hacky, you know, on the other end.
Yeah. Well, but it's curious to me because the thing I mean, why I'm talking to you for this, and the thing I see is you have a bunch of different kinds of writing and performing you do.
Right.
But it all falls under the comedy umbrella. Like,
mostly, yeah.
I mean, I know you've done some performing, a lot. You've done some sort of theatrical stuff. Maybe that's maybe more great.
I have trod the boards, Levi. Yes, I have.
But you're, it seems like your mindset is, well, let's make something funny.
I think I just sort of owned up to that to myself at some point, maybe 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Because I started as a playwright, and really the thing that was, I don't know, considered valuable in some ways in theater when I was in grad school and when I started getting serious about theater was socially relevant stuff. And as a young white dude, I'm not sure I had much to say on that score. I mean that.
But why would that stop you?
Well, yeah, exactly. It's never stopped me. And I guess my instinct was more about making people laugh and entertaining, and then maybe hiding something in there,
mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, and also that was where the grant money was. You know, there was a cynical aspect to it too. Could see myself tooling my work towards something that was a little more polemic, even though my instincts didn't go that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've done more quote unquote serious stuff, I suppose. Like we were talking before you started broadcasting about Nautilus Music Theater in town. I wrote a piece on commission with them last year, the libretto, I suppose, to a musical piece about the bridge collapsing in Minneapolis. And even in that, like, I always want to make people laugh, which is a little odd, but I think that tension works at its best, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, that, to me, one of the compelling things about comedy is it can make something awful easier to explore. I think mm-hmm. you can go a little further into a topic that is really hard if, I don't know, you pave it a little bit with that.
Absolutely,
yeah. And I think that's what that thing is that you have, where you're like, well, okay, we're going to deal with the bridge collapse, but moments of levity, so we're mm-hmm. not just exhausted.
Right.
But it's interesting that you started out, you know, writing theater. Story is really important,
mm-hmm.
but then you have, and comedically, you lean towards the absurd, and then riff tracks, that's very jokey.
There are
moments where you create a mini storyline to hang jokes upon, but the point of, I mean, absurdity can have story, but often just for the point of making a left turn that ruins the whole story like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's what I've been getting wrong. I keep doing my absurdity really straightforward. I guess not absurd in the end.
Right. I wish this absurdity was more realistic. That's your take.
I don't think they would do this.
Yeah, that note doesn't fly in an absurdist writer's room. Are you more comfortable in one sphere or the other? Like, do you sometimes, I'd love to do more telling a story, like for the Nautilus piece?
Absolutely. I sort of crave that. And, you know, I feed my habit with writing plays and even things like the Nautilus piece. I gave mm-hmm. a little narrative arc. So I'm grateful for, and I really like doing my day job, but it's fun. But I kind of need the balance of storytelling.
That's funny. So you write jokes to fund the ability to tell story.
There you go.
It's like the opposite of, like, there's so many people who are like, well, I write for this TV show, but I'm really a stand-up and I do that at night.
Right.
And you're like the flip side. We're like, I gotta crank out these jokes so I can keep.
Sorta. I should say that, you know, I don't know that I would, like, for riff tracks, it's all tied up with performing too. I get to go up there and be a ham, which I thoroughly enjoy. So.
Yeah. Can we talk about the actual joke writing process of like something in riff tracks?
By all means.
Because I know that it seems like a victory for Mystery Science Theater or Riff Tracks is to make everyone feel like it's off the cuff. It's sort of that seeming improvised thing that mm-hmm. you guys, I'm sure, still get people like, just, that's amazing that they're so fast. Like, you really do a ton of work.
I am really amazed that people still believe that we're coming up with that on the fly. and like, when I do interviews with radio people and stuff like that, they wow, you just kind of come up with that, don't you?
Tell me some jokes.
Are you out of your mind? Who in the world is that fast and that well-timed?
Yeah.
And I'm glad that we can sell it thusly, but yeah, it's kind of nuts that anyone with... Like, I've seen the smartest comic minds, I think, in the world or in the country doing stuff like that, and nobody is that good and that thorough and that articulate.
So for a movie, like, you guys did Godzilla?
Was our last Fathom event show, which is the ones that go around the movie theaters.
Right. You have to watch the movie then in advance. Do you watch it a bunch of times?
Yeah, although I've learned to just pace myself too. It's like, wait till you get into the writing. Don't get all Talmudic on it and like try to unpack it two or three times before you start the writing.
Yeah. But, so will there be a time when you get together with the other writer?
Oh yeah.
And you guys all watch. And are you writing or are you throwing out and recording yourselves? Actually riffing, like, on a first pass.
They're very separate processes. We write and write and write and then have a script and then we just record kind of like it's a radio play.
You don't capture the audio of the first watching?
No.
I don't mean to use later, but just to,
no.
For notes, it's all, like, written down notes.
No, we did, on Mystery Science Theater, we did it a little bit differently. We would all sit in the room together and watch it together for a first draft. Hmm. And it was just sort of this mass Tourette syndrome as... We would take turns manning the typing, and one person just tried to keep up with all the stuff that was being blurted out. And then from there, myself and usually two other writers would take it and try to get a first draft together from that mass of garbage that we blurted out. But we're doing it kind of backwards at this point. We're writing a first draft just alone, sort of divvied up into four or five sections between Mike and Kevin and I and our two writers. And then from there we get together and just sort of, a lot of the time we repeat stuff, from our sections, and it's not always the obvious stuff. But sometimes it's just like, what is a Fleetwood Mac? Why do we have four Fleetwood Mac references in Godzilla? Like, there's nothing that would suggest that, just as an example.
Well, if you notice something like that, will you sometimes make the choice to lean into that and go, we need 10 Fleetwood Mac? Like, if, rather than pulling
probably
back.
Probably not. If it fit and it seemed funny, but just for the sake of, it would have to be funny, even,
right.
Even in that absurd way that we, already settled.
Yeah. one challenge I imagine happens in the where you're writing jokes for a movie, but you're rewatching it several times, is you can build a joke based on some little thing that you really only notice in rewatching. Do you have any sort of checks and balances to make sure this joke will still work for, like, a first or second time viewer of
We probably should have more checks and balances. Because, yeah, you're absolutely right. We do get obsessed with little things, and I think we kind of amplify them, you know, in our own heads and between us. And then we go back sometimes, like, that really wasn't much of a moment at all. There was an example of that in Mystery Science Theater. There was some really dumb movie about the Clonus horror.
It's always a colon.
Yeah. And it starred like Dick Sargent of Latter Day Bewitched. But there was one moment where like one of the young protagonists, like he was just this doofy bro, and he was agreeing to something, and he just said what we thought was like sure. And then, you know, so we just amplified that and it went in our little echo chamber.
Yeah.
And so we made a couple of jokes on that after he did it. Then when we rewound it and looked back, it was more like, sure.
we really
do need somebody to just come in every now and then and bust our, you know, our epistematic closure or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that weird thing, if your brain's doing comedy, it's often just doing it all the time. And so you drive by and you see a weird thing on a billboard, and you're like, oh, that's funny. But you can't really, I don't know how to. I get mad because I'm like, I would have to have everyone come see this thing that I just saw for this.
Well, whip out your iPhone and tweet it. That is what to do.
I suppose that's what's happening. You're right. There's a solution to this problem.
But, we have solved this, Levi.
But it's hard because sometimes you have to give up. You know, like, this is funny to me, but it won't work with anyone else because they didn't have.
Yeah, well, sometimes the art is getting it across and getting it across efficiently.
Yeah.
Or just giving up on it, you know, and knowing that is important too.
Yeah, well, so there have to be a, I would probably guess, the majority of the things you guys write for a movie don't get in to an actual final recording.
One would think, and yet we're really not that hardworking.
Yeah.
You would think. We would work that hard, but no, we don't. Yeah, I mean, it depends on where you think the editing happens in some way. Like, at this point, having had the experience of Mystery Science Theater where, yeah, really only like 10 or 5% of that first draft of Great Incoherence makes it into the final, I think, especially with Mike, Kevin, and I, after all these years, we've just kind of learned, you know, edit a few times in your own head as you see it. Like, reconsider and reject, and then find something a little better. So our hit rate tends to be a little higher, but we are a little more, we're much more plotting doing it, you know.
So you're approaching it in a more sort of experienced way, but then you also know often your first idea is going to be the best idea. You just hone that.
No, I mean, I think maybe one of our instincts is that our first idea is not going to be our best idea. So, like, get through, like, three or four of those obvious knee-jerk things.
Uh-huh.
Know that you've done them before, that that would be the first reaction of anybody riffing a movie. You should do a little better than that, you know. And, yeah, we will grab the low-hanging fruit every now and then.
Sure,
but
sometimes just a well-placed fart sound is all you really...
Oh, yes. Sometimes, or 40% of the time with us. Your choice. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I have learned to just pedal through those first couple of, wow, if I typed this now, I'd be done with this moment.
Yeah.
I can move on. because I mean, in some ways it's just sort of a recreation of the process we started back then, which was a little more, separated into different personnel.
Yeah. So with that idea of, going back to your... Bill the Theater Guy.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's what you build yourself as.
Bill. Oh, yes. You've read my t-shirt.
Yeah, well, you are. You have been pointing at it this entire time.
Huh? Branding, Levi.
But the sort of the polemic or the saying something, you know, comedy can be a really good way of getting at it complex issues or challenging issues.
Right.
Do you feel like there are moments in a Riff Tracks where you guys still will... intentionally or unintentionally hit on something that is actually, well, that's a real complicated topic, and you touched on it just with a joke and you moved past, but it still maybe will land on somebody? And
that's a complicated topic. Let me simplify the hell out of it.
Yeah, hit it with a one-liner.
Hit it quickly. Take no responsibility.
Violence is bad.
And try to erase it with a fart joke. Well, yeah, and I, like, there are degrees of self-consciousness to that I, like, especially since we have a whole bunch of writers and we come from very different places, not only politically, but in terms of age at this point. We have two writers who are about 20 years younger than us working with us. And
so they're, like, 15.
Oh, you flatterer, you. No, they are in their mid-50s. And
that joke is way better.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting to see what they come up with, like where their heads are at. They're both great guys, you know, but every now and then we're kind of shocked at the nihilism of the jokes that they produce, even though they are like the sweetest guys in the world, and we just, you know, they're incredibly valuable to us. I think if I'm thinking too hard about if I do this, I'll get this point across, it's probably something I should rethink.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we are always doing that on some level. You can't not do it in a way.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you're commenting on a moment that, well, we do a lot of old stuff. We always have done a lot of those educational shorts from the 40s through the 70s. And those are, I mean, just anthropologically, those are amazing in themselves. And so, I mean, we can put a little spin on it that shows, all right, this is the distance we've come. And that is not too hard to do on some level. And if you hit it too hard, you just seem ham-handed.
It's not jokey anymore.
Right. Yeah. It's a little more tricky when that isn't something you can use or leverage. And I like that we come at it from a bunch of different places. And every now and then, there'll be one kind of sensibility that fights another. Like, we have plenty of jokes about big evil corporations or, you know, implications thereof. But every now and then, we'll throw an elbow at lazy union dudes or something. You know, and it's not, I don't even think we're not really rallying a cause so much. It's just like, here's an angle to consider on this. I think if we sell an agenda too hard, first of all, we're not going to agree on it. But I think audiences are pretty sophisticated in sniffing that out and feeling like, I don't want to be sold to on that level. And you know, it would be different if that was kind of our thing, but as it turns out, it is not. The way it has evolved over the years.
Those are the super political movie riffing guys, right?
Yeah, right. Which I think would be fine if it were funny. I you would have to show me that it could be funny. And I don't know how much it would need to just match up square with my political sensibilities to make it funny, you know, or not. I think that is the minefield of political humor.
It's true.
It's like, if it's not a click-in match there, we're not going to see anything funny.
Yeah. I think there's some real strength to being sort of promiscuous with your humor, you know, that you'll make...
Why shouldn't I be promiscuous with that? As much as anything else, libertine that I am. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. I think I get the sense of what you're saying. It's like, don't always try to come from the same place. I don't know.
But you are still you always, so there's...
Yeah,
there's,
I mean...
That's your limitation.
That is, and it's a really big one with me, as it turns out. Yeah, I mean, it's weird. I appreciate some kinds of political humor, but almost the fact that it is called political humor, to me, like, I'm in trouble right from the get-go. It's like, I know I'm going to be sold something from one sensibility. And I know plenty of comedians and love plenty of comedians who seem to make it work, kind of, but they're not the ones who really make me double over. And the ones who do make me double over have plenty of political stuff anyway, because you can't avoid it.
Yeah, if you're being honest about what you think, it's going to get in there.
Yeah.
You have a reputation, and in my experience, are really nice and kind person. No offense. Are you flying into a rage now?
Do not agree in the least.
But I mean, I've heard people casually, just if you come up, I mean, sometimes you do, and people are, oh, Bill's really nice.
Well, thank you.
And that doesn't always go, that doesn't always fly in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also seem to care about people, like their feelings, which can get, like, I don't think everyone who writes and does comedy...
What is the proof of that, sir?
I don't know.
I'm sitting here not caring about you right now. And
not
I
my feelings. I don't care about that. No. But, like, you're...
Well, that is very nice of you.
You're thoughtful in conversation. You do comedic and silly things, but you are aware that sometimes that they're silly and that what they can, the effect they can have on people. But I wonder if, you know, if you take a movie and you're making jokes over it, you've written a movie, you've seen the process, mm-hmm. you know what happens to people who make movies and how, like, their babies are ruined and how much work goes into all that mm-hmm. stuff. You know, actors and writers and comics, you know, some of the people who've been involved in the things you've made jokes about. Is there ever a tension for you about, I'm making fun of the thing, and I don't want to make fun of a person, or, you know, do you wrestle with that?
Yeah. It's funny you should say this now, because really, until now, I really haven't known, been close to anybody in a movie that we have riffed. Like, I've known peripherally some people, and, excuse me, actors who have been involved in some of the movies, but don't really care because we're not hitting them too hard. But just
you didn't meet the Manos people.
We actually did, but it was many decades
after.
It was very odd. But that's another story, lad. But just this past week, we wrote something called Rotor, which is like R-O-T-O, like its initials, like MASH. And it was a movie made in the late 80s in the Dallas area. And it's really terrible. I mean, it's like a RoboCop ripoff, really. And it's we love it because it is almost in that category of The Room or Manos, like that bad.
It's a gift.
And it is a real gift. Yeah. I mean, it's bad in that particularly weird way where the dialogue is very Ed Wood-like. And like, what humans talk like this or think like this? But anyway, in the middle of it, I'm watching it and, you know, trying to think of jokes. And in the middle of it, a real friend of mine pops up in the movie. You know, it was almost 20 years ago, but or it was more than 20 years ago, I guess. But at that time, we were going to grad school together. He lived in Texas. He just did it, you know, during that time. And I didn't know he was in it. And we already had a joke written comparing him to Urkel because he's a black guy with glasses. Yeah. And it was like, this is kind of weird. I don't like, I'm not in touch with him now. And that's the only thing that is kind of saving me. But I would feel obligated to say, heads up, you're about to. But in general, yeah, I feel like it's a little odd because a lot of the stuff we did in Mystery Science Theater, the people were like, they had moved so far on. Usually to the grave, I was that it really didn't. I didn't think about it much, but little by little over the years, I've thought, you know, that's if we're just like poking fun at the way somebody looks for too long, you know, a little bit of it is fine, especially if it's germane to the thing they're trying to sell. Like we love like square jawed, authoritative dudes who are just like. Being sold as like the bee's knees, and we kind of
well, you're making fun of the casting move as much as you are as a person.
Absolutely, that's I like that. but yeah, we have crossed the line of time. And I remember we did The Room, the Tommy Wiseau movie.
And how could you not?
How could we not? Although honestly, that's one that really doesn't need us to make it delightful.
It's true.
But you know, once you've seen it without, consider seeing it with us. But
it's a soft plug.
Somebody, yeah, very soft plug, which is a flaccid plug, I would say.
Fantastic. That should be a section on the website.
Would you like to do a flaccid plug for? Don't get too turgid with it now, sir.
Oh, man.
I had a joke. I didn't write it, but I did say it, and it was only after the fact that I realized about Lisa, the young woman in it that was.
Who's no longer an actor, although come back to it, I believe, now.
I don't know where she's at these days, but I think she fled for her life and sanity after that for a while, properly so. And is something like she looks like the bloated corpse of Britney Spears, which was just an awful thing to say about a young woman.
That's even mean to Britney Spears.
Oh, I know. It's bad all in every direction. So that's an example of something after the fact that I thought, I didn't really have to go that far. And especially with a person who is still out there and really
that idea of,
younger than me.
Of comedy, you should be punching up. If you're attacking something, it should be something of an authority figure, something in power. And you could
Are you suggesting the cast of The Room is not a power base in this country?
No. Clearly there's a cabal there.
They're funded by the Koch brothers.
There's a secret code, and it turns out I do have cancer. That is a coded message.
I'm glad you're familiar with the movie.
Hardly any of us could decipher.
It's really hard to explain that movie and its delight to somebody,
who
hasn't seen it. But I even show like a little bit of it, and it's like,
you have to see
that doesn't
thing.
Really show you the full glory.
I've read The Disaster Artist.
Oh, yeah?
It's a really amazing book. By Greg Sestero.
Yeah, I know Greg.
And
I will, you know, we're trying to get The Room to do for our riff tracks, and he's kind of helping us, which is great.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
But and they're making that into a movie.
Yes,
it's just
I don't know how that's going to go.
Culture is eating
Tommy
itself.
Be in it?
And then that'll be a shitty movie, and then somebody will make a movie about the making of that, and so on.
Entertainment eats its own tail. It's
you said something I think is a good general rule, the punching up
noises.
Thing. About fart noises. About farting up. Only fart on
you
things
should
with
always
more
be
power.
Farting up.
Yes.
That's a t-shirt, but the punching up thing?
Yeah, and I think like and I've heard that many times before, and I like it as a good general guideline. I think you can get carried away with it, like and that's where you're into kind of very polemical comedy. Because I do think everybody has sort of an id side that you
well,
have
punching
to like
is supposed
look
to be a metaphor,
right?
You should be making jokes.
Oh, I'm
if
sorry.
If it becomes punching,
I've been taking it quite literally.
You just walk around
just
punching
walking
upwards.
Around punching bankers and old white guys sitting on thrones looking like pigs.
I think you're in Fight Club. Is what you've just
yes.
described. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, I think I like it as a general rule.
Yeah. It's a good kind of a guidepost, but it does put on the table like what's up? Who I mean,
yeah.
What is the direction up?
Yeah.
What's up, my friend? And, you know, and we all decide what that is for ourselves. But I think just yeah, keeping that in the back of your mind as you write jokes ain't a bad idea.
What about for you with the this may be harder to talk about your childhood. No, the writing the writing
immediate
of,
weeping.
The writing of absurd stuff.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a fine line of this is a funny in an absurd way, or this just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's funny to me because will people find this funny? You know?
Yeah.
You can wonder that about a regular hard joke that is just a setup punchline.
Right.
But absurdist, that's a different sort of, there's a more subtle nuance, I think, to that. And there's really no punching up with it either, so I think it's a separate thing. But Do you feel like you're just your mind is in that place all the time and you can
partially?
Oh, this is funny to me and it'll probably work. Or
yeah, well, we kind of joked about it before, but I don't really know what to call absurd. I mean, that, like, it's certainly not an absolute non sequitur.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's like I've tried that in jokes over the years, and then I realized that's kind of nothing. I mean, all it does is really. Deny what it's a huge violation of the yes and rule in general.
Yeah.
So I don't even know what to call absurd. Even my own work, I never consciously say I can make that more absurd.
Yeah, I think of like a talking sandwich. You know, like there's do you know the sketch?
I think
show?
Of talking sandwiches a lot, Levi.
The sketch show, The State.
Eat me.
You remember that?
Yeah.
There's a scene where one it's fine sketch, but then at the end. There's a mailbox, and it
uh-huh.
just walks out of frame.
Uh-huh.
And it really doesn't have anything to do with the sketch, and it destroyed me. It was so funny to me. But that shouldn't work. That shouldn't be funny. And so that to those kinds of things, I think what I think of like an absurdist.
Yeah.
Moment, which is a different thing. Those are all visuals that I'm thinking of, and you're...
Well, there's...
You work with words a lot.
I work with way too many words. With the metric ton of words. I think, you know, I think there's, I mean, there are movements in art and theater from, you know, over 100 years ago that are absurdist and Dadaist, and it really is just about, like, here's that thing, nope, here's that, you know, here's another thing that
right.
does not relate, put it together in your own head. And when I think absurdist, probably for what I write and what my colleagues write, it's probably something closer to weird, but not, you know, like, you can get it, but it's not... It's just not what your first thought would be.
Right.
It's trying to match something up, but it's you can kind of trace it a little.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it's sometimes in a riff tracks scenario that needs a few beats to get
mm-hmm.
to a weird idea. So do you feel like you invest a little more time?
Oh, yeah. And I feel like we need to be weirder every now and then. Just almost as a palate cleanser, you know, that if we're too relentlessly focused on the beats of the movie, it's a little exhausting for us and probably for the audience, mostly for the audience. Like, you can point out what's going on and make jokes on it. And generic sarcasm is something that we have like a big no-no on.
It's
like,
pretty lazy, right?
It's lazy and it's easy and it's, you know, that first instinct I was talking about before,
yeah.
you know, the thing like, oh, right, that's what he'd do. Like that.
Did he just do that for 2 hours?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
But when not very good writers have sort of auditioned for us or something, like that's what you get a lot of. You get like, oh, come on, like he'd go in that door. Like, oh no. And
that's
even
what it's like when you're just sitting in a movie theater.
Oh yes. In private I do. But I mean, even if you use that basic premise, you have to make it a little more elegant than that. And we do plenty of that, believe me, but every now and then I just feel like, well, it has to just be a little, I don't know, a little more substantive or weird or artsy or something like that to satisfy me. Like, that's what would keep me in the seed.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is interaction between us three that is only tangentially related to what's going on screen, because what's going on screen is really boring. We don't take it out of that much, but every now and then we indulge.
I really like the phrase now, elegant sarcasm.
It goes with my... That's the back of my t-shirt.
Elegant sarcast.
Theater guy.
You do the drafts and then you record the audio for the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because you guys really know what you're doing, you've probably pretty much figured out how it's all going to play out. And there isn't a ton of actually, I just now thought of that while we're recording. But are there still moments of...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When we're in the recording session, we stop all the time and realize, we kind of said that already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are just so many comments or jokes in the course of any one of our things that we try to weed it out, but we don't always succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then we'll have a better spin on something in the moment. And I like that. I like rewriting on the fly.
Do you have a thing where one of you will be like, classic Kevin? Like, do you guys have your go-tos that each other recognizes, even if maybe not the bigger audience?
Yeah, I mean, surprisingly few over the years. I mean, as I've said before, like, Kevin has a wonderful singing voice, so we tend to give stuff, especially difficult singing stuff, to him, although it's not 100%. I mean, Mike and I can carry a tune, but Kevin can actually make it sound good. Yeah, and just other things like various imitations that we seem to have stumbled into doing over the years.
Of certain actors?
Yeah, or certain actors. Yeah. Like, Mike does a really good Nick Nolte.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he really gets that feeling of having scraped the inside of your throat with a wire bottle brush.
Well, and he does a ton of blow, right, before each recording?
Oh, yeah. Just so like helps. A big, quart container full of blow.
Because
I seem to do angry New Yorkers, being an angry New Yorker myself. And then, sort of counterintuitively, I do effete Englishman often.
Nice.
Those are my two,
I like those go-tos.
As particular imitations, I don't know. But yeah, we kind of do that. But really not a lot of that. We just kind of divvy up the lines and don't write for each other, like one person in particular, that precisely.
I'm going to try and wrap up.
Sure. I hear that. That is a podcast
term,
right?
In a non-elegant way. Yeah, very. Yeah. It didn't exist prior to podcasting.
Very podcastian.
But I'm curious if you have, like, a joke or a comedy moment that you love from... It can be, like, from whenever. It can be something you're a part of. Like, if there's something that...
Oh, dear.
I didn't prep you for this.
No,
all,
you
so
did
it's
not.
It's not fair of me.
And you know that I'm like... right now, I'm oscillating wildly between...
Sounding good and...
Like, yeah, like, wanting so... Wanting to say so many moments that I had fun in, and then doubting them as they're popping up in my head.
There's no right answers.
That's no, but there are many, many wrong answers.
Right. Just embrace it.
Gee, I don't know. And writing moments, this is not elegant at all, but one moment that I'm proud of writing, and I think Kevin actually got the line, was we did a little special, like blockbuster specials for Mystery Science Theater back in the day. And one of the movies was Titanic.
Yeah.
Well, we could only get the electronic press kits for it. So we did like snippets. And just as the Titanic is launching off, it pans over the captain looking proudly over the stern of the ship. And I wrote, "I'm going to sink this bitch." And it just worked like a charm with his...
How dare you call that not elegant?
So I'm proud of that one. And I think just for performing, God, I just had so... It was so much fun performing on Mystery Science Theater because I got to do a whole bunch of things. I mean, I kind of like the... evolving weirdness of the observer character I played, mm-hmm. that he liked to go out and like he was this omniscient alien from another planet, but he had this kind of sketchy nightlife, going out to clubs, leather clubs and stuff like that, and wanting to dance just a little too much. I did a full-out flash dance routine at one point with the chain of, you know, the bucket coming down,
yeah.
and all nice. That. And I guess that says something about me, that I enjoyed that so much.
Yeah. That is elegant.
There was nothing elegant about it. I think the tape proves it.
Yeah, it's a bludgeon of comedy. Well, that's excellent. And so where are the best internet... I mean, Bill Corbett, on Twitter, you're at Bill Corbett.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty simple.
Yeah.
You Tumble. You have a Tumblr?
I Tumble for all of you. Yes. I will do a non-flaccid plug.
Okay.
I do have a comic book coming out.
Yeah.
It's a funny comic book, hopefully, but it's called Superpowered Revenge Christmas. And you can get to it on the site, just those words, superpoweredrevengechristmas.com. And it's coming out like this week.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, hooray. Cool. Well, thanks for your time, Bill.
Thanks, Levi. It was fun.
Yeah. What's So Funny is produced by mnartists.org. You can go to mnartists.org to find other episodes and to find more information about all the great arts happening in the Twin Cities.